Predicting what intervention will produce a positive impact using only consensus and deductive reasoning can be hard. Prediction markets and forecasting tournaments pose a potential solution. The following panel will analyze how these tools can be used in the domain of cause prioritization. Before we get started, I also want you to know that you can go to the website, eaglobal.org, pull up the individual page for this session, and there will be a link where you can submit questions for the panelists. Toward the end of our session, we'll have some time where your questions will be surfaced and panelists will have a chance to answer. So with that, it's my pleasure to introduce our moderator first, Julia Galef. Julia is the president and co-founder of the Center for Applied Rationality, an organization teaching math and cognitive science-based techniques for effective decision-making. Julia's work on rationality has been featured in publications such as the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Discover, Slate, Fast Company, and Vice. Since 2010, she's been the host of the popular Rationally Speaking podcast. Welcome, Julia Galef. Next up is Owen Cotton Barrett. He is a research fellow at the Future of Humanity Institute. He has a PhD in mathematics from the University of Oxford and was a founding member of Giving What We Can. He also founded and led research for the Global Priorities Project and has written papers in mathematics, economics, philosophy, and his research currently focuses on how we can prioritize between pressing problems under conditions of uncertainty. Please welcome Owen Cotton Barrett. Robin Hanson is next. Robin would like to signal that he needs no introduction. Apparently it's true. All right, Jason Matheny is last. Dr. Matheny is director of IARPA, a role that he assumed in 2015 after serving as a program manager and office director. Before IARPA, he worked at Oxford University, the World Bank, the Applied Physics Laboratory, the Center for Biosecurity, and Princeton University, and also founded two biotechnology companies. His research has been published in Nature, and he has been profiled in the New York Times, Scientific American, and The Economist. He holds a PhD in applied economics and a master's in public health from Johns Hopkins, an MBA from Duke, and a bachelor's from the University of Chicago. Please welcome Jason Matheny.
Thanks, Nathan. So there are three reasons why I think predictions are important for effective altruists to talk about. The first reason is that we need to rely on the forecasts made by other people when we're making our decisions about where to spend our time or donate our money, what policies to or interventions to support. So we should ideally have a sense of how reliable those forecasts are. So that's one thing that I want us to talk about today. The second reason is that we are all the time making our own predictions, whether explicitly or implicitly, when we decide what interventions to support or when we make assumptions about what risks are likely to develop when and how bad they'll be. So I also want to talk about strategies for making more effective, more accurate forecasts as effective altruists. And then the third reason I think this is important is something that Phil Tetlock touched on yesterday in his Skype fireside chat, which is that making predictions is a sign that you're actually trying to get the right answer, the most accurate answer possible, instead of, by contrast, trying to sound smart or signal that you're virtuous, for example. And this trait of actually trying to get the right answer is at the core of what I really love and value about effective altruism, that I think we really do this more than most people, and that it's at the very least a value that we're committed to, even if we don't always hit it perfectly. And I think there's plenty of room for improvement there, and that having a norm or institutions centered around making predictions is the kind of thing that could help foster that spirit. So, three things on our agenda: evaluating other people's forecasts, making better forecasts ourselves, and establishing cultural norms of predictions and forecasts. So, to kick things off, I'd like to invite each of my panelists to just give you a brief intro into how they have made forecasts themselves or studied the process of forecasting. Owen, do you want to start?
Sure. So, the main place where I think about forecasts is in trying to choose between different courses of action to help the world, and help the world potentially in the long run. And this is something where there's lots of uncertainty. We can't just be data-driven. We need to have some view over what might happen in the long run and the ways that actions we take interface with that. And so we need to forecast, and the higher the quality of the forecast, the better we may hope to make a difference to the world. And this matters. I think it's hard, but I think we have to try.
Great. Robin?
I've spent the last 4 years writing a book that was just published called The Age of M, Work, Love, and Life When Robots Rule the Earth. I'll talk about it a little later today. That's all about forecasting a particular technology scenario roughly in a century or so. So I've been doing a lot of forecasting there, and I've spent a big chunk of my career developing technology or forecasting mechanisms, social institutions for forecasting, prediction markets and related mechanisms.
Great. And Jason?
So IARPA funds a number of forecasting tournaments in which we tried to better understand the limits and potential for forecasting. So we funded some of Robin's work, we funded work by Phil Tetlock, and we funded work by a number of other researchers in academia and industry to look at forecasting geopolitical events, disease events, economic events, political instability, cyber events. And I think one of the goals for us has been to determine where should we be humble in our ability to forecast events, where will society need to be resilient, and then maybe are there some cases where, in fact, we can be quite confident about our ability to foresee events?
Great. Well, that's actually where I want to start with this question of, generally speaking, how capable are we, are humans, at making predictions? And to be more specific, are there certain types of things we're good at making predictions about, and certain types of things we're bad at making predictions about? What kinds of criteria would you use to decide how reliable a forecast can be in an area? You can feel free to jump in.
I'm in favor of expressing forecasts in the form of probabilities. Mm-hmm. If you have somebody who expresses a probability and it's well calibrated, it tells you how accurate it is. You don't have to figure it out. You can just listen to the probability.
To rephrase my question, what areas do you expect people to be well calibrated in? Where well calibrated just means that if I, out of the set of things I say I'm 80% confident will happen, roughly 80% of them actually do happen instead of, 20, for example.
I think that, I actually want to answer a question which is related, but I think that well calibration matters, but also matters is where we can be precise and where we can be confident in our forecasts, and that may matter more, because there are some areas where, even if we're well calibrated, we just have to shrug our shoulders a lot and say, well, it could go either way. We are normally better at forecasts in the short run than the long run, but when we're looking at the long run, we can be better forecasting general trends than specific details. I think it would have been not that hard to look back, from the perspective of 1950 to say the world economy will be bigger in the year 2000 than it is now, and perhaps even to project roughly how much bigger. Mm-hmm. And it would have been harder to say which companies would be at the top of the would have risen most. And,
right.
And general, the finer the detail we get down to, the harder it is to make predictions.
Now, Robin's book has a lot of fine detail in it.
It does.
It does.
How do you feel about that?
Me or him?
Either of you.
Well, I'm explicit that I'm not giving great confidence to each piece of detail. And, of course, the conjunction of all the details is ridiculously unlikely. Nevertheless, I think it's valuable to construct these prototype examples. It's the usual thing we do in most practical business forecasting. If you make a plan for a building construction project, you do usually pick a particular prototype event of the order, what happens and how long things take, knowing that each of those things is going to be off. But still, it's valuable to put together a coherent plan. That's what the National Intelligence Services do as well. They create particular forecasts about particular scenarios, and that makes sense to me.
And actually, a lot of the fine details in Robin's book do come from reading out quite general trends rather than telling super specific stories.
you have a kind of nested a hierarchy of predictions where there's some more general ones that you express more confidence in, and then as you get further and further down into, you know, exactly what the M's will be named, you know, maybe have less confidence?
I give various qualifying phrases along the way somewhat randomly, so it's not very systematic.
That's something. Jason, did you have thoughts?
So I think we're pretty early on in the systematic study of forecasting accuracy, which is embarrassing as a society that has to spend most of its time thinking about the future in order to make plans. But there's very little empirical research on the accuracy of forecasting, particularly over longer timescales. So there's a lot of work in meteorology, and there we know that say beyond about 2 weeks out, your models are not going to be reliable, and you might as well just look at what the weather was a year ago in order to make a forecast. So there we have significantly improved the ability to forecast, but we've also significantly improved our ability to understand the limits of forecasting. There's no other domain of forecasting that's so well developed, but we're beginning to understand more about what the limits of forecasting, macroeconomic conditions, foreign elections, disease events to some extent. Flu is easier to predict than, say, rare disease outbreaks. One of the things that I think most appeals to me about the exercise of running forecasting tournaments is that we build up the body of knowledge that society has about the quality of its forecasts, but also, as you sort of described, the degree of sincerity that we have in making judgments. And it's important to do this not just for forecasts, but for other sorts of judgments about uncertainty, judgments about the present, as well as judgments about the past that are at least in principle falsifiable. Mm-hmm. I think the main message is we should just be keeping score on these judgments as a society.
So Jason's organization funded a particular study of 1,000 technology forecasts, if I recall, where they went and looked in journals for people forecasting things many years out, and they found it was definitely better than average. But a fun fact was that like 5 or 10% of the predictions were predicting a date for a technology in the future that had already been achieved when they were making the forecast.
That's right. Yeah.
So with respect to your long-term future predictions and your point about, you know, if we're calibrated, then, you know, what does it matter? Though that's all you need to know. I mean, when you're making long-term predictions, you don't really get the feedback from that set of predictions, at least, about how well calibrated you are. You can get feedback from shorter-term predictions that you've made in other domains, and you can see, look, I'm calibrated on, you know, forecasting political events 1 month out. But how much does that good track record, that calibration track record, really generalize to, you know, us believing that we should take seriously your farther future forecasts? Where the you here is general, not just you.
I would say futurism is theory. That is,
as distinct
we
from...
don't have data about the future. We're not doing much direct inference. We are mainly taking the theories we have generated from data in the past and then applying them to the future. So we have theories at a wide range of abstractions. Some of our theories are very specific and some of them are very general. The farther you go away from existing experience, the more you're going to have to move up to more general theories. But we do have a lot of pretty general theories, and so I'm able to say a lot in my book, I think, because I have learned a lot of different fields and able to apply them, their standard theories. So I think the right thing to do on any topic is to first take our most standard, widely accepted theories and just apply them to the situation at hand straightforwardly and just ask what they say. And it turns out there's a lot of subjects where you can get a lot of progress that way because people haven't bothered to try.
I agree with Robin that, like, it is going to be theoretical. I think that when we're building theories about the future, one thing we can do is we can try to decompose them and look at the pieces, and for each piece, try to stress test that by going and saying, is this essentially the same as something which we already have data for in the present or in the past, or is it something where we have a deep theoretical understanding and we really feel that we understand the pieces inside, so we have more confidence in this. And that can help us to calibrate our confidence in the different kinds of theories we can build about the future, and also to spot when we are unhappy and we'd like to be replacing part of them.
This might be putting you on the spot, but can you think of a even a hypothetical example of what that might look like, where you're taking a piece of your overall prediction? I mean, you could take Robin, the age of M, as a test case if you want, or something else.
Yeah, I mean, you could think, well, if we have this new technology and then read out, I expect this will have an effect on the economy, mm-hmm. and you could compare this to try and identify what the salient features of the predicted technology are, find analogs in the past, and look at the effect of the economy. Make the predictions, ideally, before looking at what the effect was. This is a little bit hard because we all have different bits of background knowledge about how bits of technology turned out, resting around in our heads. But you can try to blind yourself to that, make predictions, then go and look up the data and see how well it turned out and if it's roughly matching up or not.
Read history.
Read history as well. Read history after you've...
After you've made guesses about the history.
Read history in chronological order and guess along the way.
Julie, I think to your question about to what extent do, say, methods and people who perform well on short-term forecasts do well on long-term forecasts, mm-hmm. We, again, have very little data. I mean, the data that we have, say, from the IARPA forecasting tournaments only goes out a few years. And mm-hmm. for that, there is some reassuring result, which is that the same methods and people who do well on shorter range forecasts do well on the sort of mid-range forecasts. But as to whether that should give us confidence about, you know, a forecast that's 20 years out, I don't know. I mean, the largest study that I know of long range forecasting was Phil Tetlock's earlier work mm-hmm. on expert political judgment, which wasn't very encouraging mm-hmm. In terms of forecasting accuracy. And then there's another study that was done that is very rarely cited, but I think one of the most interesting studies that government has funded on the topic of forecasting. It was the assistant secretary for research and engineering at DOD funded a work on retrospective analysis of technological forecasts dating back 50 years. And it ranged from forecasts that might be a few months out to forecasts that were decades out. And what's remarkable about that study was that it included a large sample of forecasts, over 500 from a variety of technology areas, a variety of different methods that were used. And the general finding was that no method performed more reliably than a coin flip out beyond several years. So I think the result of the small amount of information that we have so far on long-range forecasting is that it's probably not very good, unfortunately.
And were those, you were referencing comparing individual methods to chance. That reminds me a little bit of the distinction that Tetlock makes in his expert political judgment and super forecasting between foxes and hedgehogs, where hedgehogs have one method or one framework that they're using to make their prediction, and foxes kind of intuitively, organically combine different models or different frameworks in whatever way seems sensible to them to try to make their forecast. Is it possible that the problem in that study was that they were all hedgehogs, or am I off base?
Maybe. I think I don't think that the DOD study tried to categorize the participants in those historical studies. I don't think those data were available. It is true that in Tetlock's study, the foxes performed better than the hedgehogs.
Right.
But by a small margin, I mean, in terms of practical terms, the advantages that foxes have weren't that substantial. Hmm. One of the findings from Tetlock's earlier work was, though, that you could outperform both the foxes and the hedgehogs just by taking the average of a bunch of judgments. And that appears in a footnote in the book. But it was really the inspiration for the program at IARPA to run a large forecasting tournament involving tens of thousands of people whose judgments were averaged in various ways. And the outcome of that study was it's really hard to beat the unweighted average of judgments in a group unless you have very strong evidence that there are some people who are going to be better forecasters than others.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
I think it's important to notice that there are lots of predictions we make that are long-term and reliable. That is, these various statistics are focused on particular questions of interest that are hard. But every time you build a building, you're making forecasts about how long it'll last. True. Every time you start a company, every time, you know, all sorts of things we do have implicit forecasts in them, and many of them are quite reasonable.
Good point.
I think that's right, and that these questions were often, they were using the same questions that they had been testing shorter-term forecasts over, and the shorter-term forecast, they deliberately chosen questions which weren't too easy over the short time period, and then they became hard over the longer time period. It's not a huge surprise. Jason, I'm interested, a thing you said just now was that unless you've got strong evidence over who the best forecasters are, it's hard to beat an unweighted average. This sounds surprising to me. I would have thought that even if you had only weak evidence over who the best forecasters were, then you would be better taking a weighted average where you assign a little bit more weight to the people who you believe to be better forecasters.
Yeah, we were surprised by that too. So in the ACE forecasting tournament, which was a four-year research effort involving multiple teams, and I think collectively generated about 2 million judgments that were scored for accuracy. The unweighted average was very difficult to beat. The team that did consistently beat it, which was led by Phil Tetlock and Barb Mellers, did find the characteristics of forecasters that were most highly correlated with accuracy. And they were not the characteristics that most of us intuitively assign as being important in forecasting. So they didn't relate to domain expertise. Domain expertise was responsible for between 1 and 2% of the variance in forecasting accuracy, which is humbling for those of us who have been spent a lot of time trying to cultivate expertise in an area to find that it doesn't matter much in these kinds of forecasting exercises.
Was there a lot of variance?
There was.
In domain expertise?
Yeah, so the people who were best at forecasting were people who had a set of cognitive characteristics. They were deeply critical of their own judgment. They did scored very well on tests of fluid intelligence, tests of critical thinking skills, tests of cognitive reflection, their ability to be slow thinkers as opposed to going with their first impulse. And they constantly revise their judgments when presented with new information as opposed to sticking to their guns.
I'd like to critique the emphasis on those parameters. Those are useful parameters, but honestly, when subjects of forecasting come up, people mainly want to know which people are better. And the more important thing socially is which institutions are better. So Tetlock couldn't have found out these results if he hadn't used superior institutions for rewarding forecasters relative to the other institutions we have. So the biggest potential we have is to create and apply, to deploy better institutions for encouraging forecasting rather than collecting a list of who's better than who.
I agree with that.
Yeah. I'm not sure I agree with that. That seems just orthogonal to me. Like the question of whether institutions are better than individuals seems separate from the question of what individual or what kind of institution is going to be better. And if these are the characteristics that are better, that make for better forecasters, why wouldn't you want to select for those people in your institutions?
For some kinds of institutions, you do need to choose carefully. When you have a committee of 12 people and half of them are bozos, you're going to have problems. But other kinds of institutions, such as speculative markets, you don't have to choose who participates. You can not choose and they will self-select and you can get good results. So it's usually better actually to use institutions where you don't have to know who's better. They are more robust and will give you better results.
Although I think that there are reasons to focus on who is good and what kinds of methods are good as well as this. One is that sometimes setting up institutions is expensive. If I just want to make my personal best guesses as to the future in order to choose to where to donate money, then I don't have the resources to set up an institution, and I would like to know either who to just go and ask their opinion or what kind of methods ought I to be using in reading out into the future. Another thing is that these institutions aggregate knowledge and they aggregate the kinds of expertise that's represented by individuals, and the better institutions do a better job of taking the high-quality knowledge and discarding the low-quality knowledge. But the trick of working out what methods produce high-quality knowledge in the first place is a bit orthogonal to this, and if we develop better methods for individuals to use, then that can feed into the individual predictions, which can feed into the things going into the aggregation methods and improve the overall quality.
So I have a blog called Overcoming Bias, you may have heard of, and so I've focused on the concept of bias, and I think these questions vary depending on whether you can trust yourself to be honest about the question or not. If you can basically trust yourself to be honest, then yes, you should collect methods and apply them. But for many of our most important topics, you can't trust yourself to be honest so much. And
even
I'm
if
more
your
skeptical.
Predictions are objective and clearly falsified or not falsified, how are you fooling yourself?
Well, it's a matter of when.
You're talking about long-term predictions that you can't...
Or just important predictions about, like, what'll happen if Trump's elected or something like that. I mean, you just might be very emotionally invested in that, and you might not have that much in the way of personal incentives to be accurate relative to incentives to, you know, echo the opinions of your colleagues. And so in cases like that, it might be hard for you to trust your own judgment. And in such cases, I would more trust you to change your incentives, i.e. to change your context, that would give you more incentives to be accurate, rather than just having a checklist of how to be rational or how to be accurate.
I mean, it seems right to me if you're able to do this, and I just think that there's the trade-offs that sometimes going to the institutions, if they don't already exist, is more expensive, and it's useful being able to know how to do the other.
So we've talked about some of the domains in which prediction has already made inroads or shown itself to be at least somewhat useful, including intelligence analysis, and I guess internally at some companies, we didn't talk about that. That's another way prediction has been used. I'm wondering if there are additional domains that you think are sort of ripe for prediction, that the success of those domains could be significantly improved if there were institutions of prediction. For example, one that I've been interested in is predictions in science, investigating or trying to predict which research is going to pan out and end up being valuable or which theories are going to pan out. I know, Robin, you looked at that some years ago. I'd be curious to hear, you know, why that doesn't seem to have taken off, if I'm correct that it hasn't taken off, and also to hear about any other domains that you guys think.
Jason knows more also some things about the subject, but I would say that we consistently see in a wide range of areas of life that people have available to them more accurate ways to forecast that they don't use. And so there's a set of consistent puzzles about why people make so little use of not just prediction markets, but experiments and track records and other sorts of things. So, for example, when people hire lawyers, they almost never know their track record at court of how many cases they've won or lost. That information is publicly available, but is almost never paid attention to. Patients who choose doctors almost never know the track record of the doctor in their previous patients, and nor are they very interested. There's a wide range of examples like this that suggest that it's not just a matter of having access to poor institutions, but often even with very simple mechanisms that are available, people show a surprising disinterest.
I think science, the funding of science and the decisions that lead to the funding of science is one area where at least I feel at sort of odds with the research literature. Because the standard process for government agencies like mine or National Science Foundation or National Institutes of Health, but also for a range of foundations that receive proposals, they submit the proposals to a range of expert reviewers who come to a table and deliberate. And most of what we know about the quality of human judgment suggests that's not the process you should be using to make sound judgments about what to fund. And yet that is almost universally used as the method to decide what sort of science to fund. So I think at IRPA we've sometimes fantasized about running a controlled experiment in which you decide what to fund using a variety of different mechanisms. So you sort of run a like randomized control trial, and maybe one group is using this deliberative model that's the standard. Maybe another group is using some form of crowdsourcing or aggregative judgment in which you poll a whole bunch of people and take the average, or use a prediction market in which you're forecasting the impact that a particular study will have some years hence. And maybe you also create a regression model or something else to try to forecast what the impact of that study would be, and see which of these methods was actually most accurate in predicting the future value of the research. As I said, right now that's just a fantasy, but I think actually that would be a really worthwhile experiment to advance the overall goal of accelerating science.
I'd love to see that experiment. Though I think that one of the challenges with it is this question of how you evaluate impact later and how you set up that you're going to do this. And this is a problem in some cases establishing when we'd like to have prediction markets, is that we don't know exactly how to specify, how to cash it out. For instance, one thing we might love to have prediction markets for is how cost-effective are charities? I think if we had these, if we had high-quality aggregated information, a lot of us would think that's really worthwhile and could use it to make decisions about what we were doing to try and help the world. But we have a problem that right now we don't have a good way of establishing a ground truth in the future to evaluate these predictions on, and that makes it hard to get the market going.
What do you mean by a ground truth?
What I mean is we... prediction markets, normally you've got a very concrete specified question, will this occur, will this index be higher than a certain number on a certain date? And so people know exactly what they're comparing, and when you come to the time, you can go and just look it up and everybody agrees on what that is. Mm-hmm. In the case of charity effectiveness, we could have markets now... I mean, maybe there's a way to do this. Maybe someone out in the audience is getting an idea and thinking, oh, no, I think that's solvable.
I'll
in which
check
case,
the,
fantastic.
The question list.
But it's hard. There's no... We don't have a consensus now on exactly how cost-effective different charities were 20 years ago. And so that means that if we'd had a prediction market 20 years ago about what we'd think, there wouldn't be an easy way to cash that out and to resolve who should be paying who.
So sometimes it's hard to agree on the past. So if you can't agree on the past, it'll be hard to agree on similar futures. Sometimes it's hard to forecast things you could agree on in the future. Sometimes it's hard to create institutions that would help us forecast together. But I also call attention to the fact there are many things today that people have pretty reliable forecasts for that they ignore. So for example, in the last week, the New York Times had another article about evidence-based medicine applied to surgery. And there are some surgeries that were... had a bunch of experiments done that showed they didn't really have much of a benefit, and they keep doing them a decade later. We have many other examples of things like that where there is clear evidence. So, for example, you're going to get, on average, a lower rate of return if you invest in a managed fund versus an index fund. But that doesn't seem to move people much.
Although, hopefully in EA, we really do care about getting the right answer more than maybe the average person, and are maybe more familiar with the value that prediction markets or tournaments add, and therefore would do better.
Who's in an index fund?
I see a couple hands. Are there ways that we could implement markets in EA that might be, you know, easier or more straightforward than something like charity cost effectiveness? Like, and I mean to include things like how could we logistically set up these institutions such that they would be not overwhelmingly burdensome in terms of time and not create perverse incentives and stuff like that.
Well, I mean, Robin has done a lot of work thinking about decision markets, so markets whose outcomes are conditional. So if we pursue course of action A, we'll have result R with, you know, probability P. If we pursue instead course of action B, we'll have a different result with a different probability. And I think one of the benefits of thinking about decision markets within organizations is that you could at least get a sort of straw poll of what a variety of people think will be the effect of pursuing a policy decision or a management change or a project that might have a high cost. And that sort of candor that you get from a poll or a market is, I think, something that has value in itself. Additionally, it would be great if more organizations would actually evaluate the accuracy of those sorts of mechanisms that they use internally. Google, I think, deserves credit for actually publishing some of the work that they did using their own internal prediction market, and they used it for a variety of corporate decisions. I think Hewlett-Packard did some similar publishing of their own results. It would be great if more organizations, including EA organizations, did that.
Open Philanthropy Project has started publishing their predictions about how the charities they're investing in or the causes they're investing in will have performed in a year or 2 years.
That's great.
Yeah, it's still small scale, but it's transparent and definitely on the right track, I think.
Often the limitation is just making a commitment to publish these numbers later. Mm-hmm. I once gave a talk at the Department of Energy, and they said they fund research based on estimating energy saved by various research projects, which they thought they could measure after the fact. And I said, well, let's look at your track record of energy saved. And they say, oh, we don't have that. Uh-huh. They haven't actually bothered on all their previous funded projects to collect a number, which is how much energy they had saved. Turned out that was just awkward because most of them didn't look very good. So they just had a few that they thought were high numbers, and they publicized those. So in many organizations, honestly, just making track records is the first step. People often don't actually just write down a record of what's actually happened in the past.
Mm-hmm. Setting aside the logistical challenges of setting up these markets and caching and concretizing the questions of interest, are there political or emotional challenges? Like, I have some anecdotal evidence that having a norm of making predictions and especially making bets can turn a climate of we're collaborating to try to figure this question out together into, okay, well, we've got our sides now, and here's my side and here's your side, and I, you know, am going to, like, root for my side and hope not to find out anything that would support your side. And maybe, you know, the right answer wins out in the end, and that's... So it's a valuable institution in that way, but it seems like there's a risk of hampering the thinking of the individuals once they've staked out a side.
So some of the most successful corporate markets have been forecasting whether deadlines are made and in corporations.
Like
and
betting against someone else making their deadline?
Well,
or
a deadline in our organization, we set up a record of whether we will make the deadline, but of course we can participate and other people might participate as well. These have had some of the most dramatic successes compared to existing story. That is, the manager said, yes, we'll make the deadline, and then the market says 2% chance or something like that, and of course the market's right. And there's two ways to understand why this is not something they like. One is that managers are often trying to get employees to go right on the edge of putting in the maximal effort. And for that, if it's a 1% chance or a 99% chance, you say, why should I put in much effort? Either way, it won't make that much difference. But it's at 50% chance, then, hey. And so managers are often trying to, like, distort the perception so that it puts you on the edge of thinking there's a 50% chance. If you work hard, we could just make it. But it's iffy, and you have to work really hard. So that's one reason why it's often more motivating to not tell people exactly the true probability of making a deadline. And another thing is that if you are a manager who might fail because this project will not make its deadline, you're looking for an excuse. And the favorite excuse of everybody if you don't make a deadline is the thing that killed my project, it came out of left field, no one can have seen that coming, it'll never happen again, don't blame me or anyone else, let's just forget about it. Mm-hmm. If you've got a market that says all the way along it's going to fail, it's going to fail, it's going to fail, and now you say it came out of left field, no one could have seen that coming, it doesn't really work. So these are some of the reasons why in real organizations these are politically problematic.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and we were talking earlier about incentives, and I remember reading a paper that you co-wrote, I think, about a clever strategy for incentivizing, like getting insurance companies to be motivated to accurately assess biosecurity risks because they would be providing insurance. That seemed like a clever strategy to me that hopefully you can elaborate on, and that I wonder might have more general applications, if you can, like, find ways to give institutions' incentives to forecast accurately.
I mean, it's the general trick of trying to put something into a market so that the actors who are making the predictions have skin in the game and the incentives push them towards being as accurate as they can. Right now, risks of a pathogen escaping from a laboratory and causing a pandemic are basically uninsured, or the state is picking up the tab for this. And the state is often not really... The state is thinking about lots of different things and isn't paying much attention to the fact that it might be picking up the tab for this small risk. And the people who are making the decisions about whether to go ahead often think, well, this is exciting research, and it's a pretty small risk, and, like, we don't think that'll happen. And they're right, it probably won't happen. But it means that the incentives aren't there for them to make accurate predictions. And so the idea is, if you could instead ask insurance companies to cover the risk, the insurance companies would have the correct incentives. Now, there's a number of challenges for that, because there aren't that many people doing this kind of research, and there isn't much of a track record of it. And so the insurance companies would like to build good models, or would like to go and look up the data and find out how much does this happen, and then they'll have good reasons for having their beliefs and setting the premiums. And that isn't going to be the case, and that introduces friction towards even trying to get a market going. Mm-hmm. But it's a case where if you can align the incentives, you get an institution which should produce at least well-calibrated estimates, not necessarily accurate estimates. Mm-hmm. And it is also illustrative of this fact that there are obstructions to setting up institutions. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it'll happen.
So given the fact that in at least some cases, for at least the time being, we just may not be able to make very accurate predictions, even if we're well-calibrated, is there some way that we can, are there strategies for planning without having accurate predictions at our disposal? Like, are there ways to design our plans so that they have this quality that Taleb called anti-fragility, where they're robust to these black swan catastrophes coming out of nowhere, coming out of left field, and throwing a wrench in your plans, and you haven't predicted exactly what that black swan will be, but you assume there will be something, and you've built in sort of robustness into your plan. Like, if we're planning to reduce our susceptibility to existential or global catastrophic risks, are there strategies that are just basically good, you know, no matter what the risk is, even ones that we can't predict, for example?
So I think we probably have to be choosy in which sorts of scenarios we decide to become anti-fragile towards, or sort of robustly resilient towards, because it's expensive. So to give one example, in biosecurity, if you're not sure about what kind of biological attack or biological accident is likely, then you could decide, well, we want to develop the tools that are robust against a range of different scenarios. A bunch of different viruses, a bunch of different bacteria, and you could then invest in what are called, you know, broad spectrum countermeasures, things that are effective against broad classes of organisms. The downside of that is that broad spectrum countermeasures are more expensive than the sort of one drug, one bug countermeasures that we traditionally develop. So you want to make sure, I think, as a society, that you have you've picked the right things to be resilient towards, and I think that that kind of exercise requires some assignment of probability. So, in the case of say biosecurity, you probably want to know what's the likelihood of us having to deal with a unknown pathogen versus a small set of known pathogens. Without assigning those probabilities, I'm not sure that you could pick what to be anti-fragile towards.
I think that it's like really important to know where your kind of predictability horizon kicks in, and where, how far you think roughly you can predict what's going on, and how far where it just stops and you think, well, it's becoming extremely uncertain. And I think we can make plans even into that bit where it becomes uncertain, but we want to plan for things which look robustly good going forwards. We don't want to have particular detailed concrete plans about I'm going to do this and that will cause this and so on for 20 steps leading 50 years into the future. That just isn't going to work. But what you could do is you could say, well, I'm worried about this thing which might happen 2 or 4 decades from now. I don't know what's going to be good, but what I do know is if there's a group of serious people who are set up and looking into this, like, there's just lots of different ways that could make things go better and relatively few that it could go worse. And so aiming for these things which are robustly good, and sometimes that means kind of trying to pass the buck off to our epistemic superiors in the future, seems like a good strategy, even when we can't predict. Mm-hmm.
So we've got a number of good questions here from the audience, and One of them I'd like to toss to you guys is, what's the best way to remove human bias from prediction? And my own addition to that question would be that it seems to me that humans are especially biased when it comes to very small probability events, which I think is particularly relevant to a lot of the catastrophic risks that effective altruists care about. And so I'm wondering if that's the kind of thing that is in fact corrected for by prediction markets. It seems like it's harder to correct for than other kinds of bias. But I'll you know, open the question up to any kind of debiasing advice you have.
Well, it helps to have a diverse group to average over. So if you think of a judgment as being something that you can decompose into the truth plus random error plus sort of systematic bias, if you average over a bunch of judgments, and you're going to cancel out the random error, and if you average over judgments whose biases are different, then you'll cancel out much of the systematic bias. Part of the challenge is it's hard to know what kinds of differences or diversity you should be going for in that exercise of aggregation. So which are the kinds of biases that are most likely to handicap a forecast of, say, a low probability event? Mm-hmm. And for that, we just have very little information. Because of the nature of low probability events, conducting empirical research with a sufficient sample size is really hard. When we put out a request for information that IRPA puts out regularly on new ideas for how to perform testing and evaluation of forecasting methods for low probability events, we were very hungry for some new approach that would allow us to do empirical research in this area, and we just haven't found it. So I think, unfortunately, we still have an extremely limited data set on how good we are at forecasting, you know, existential risks. Mm-hmm. We should be thankful that we don't have a data set on existential events.
Almost by definition.
Right.
So some institutions like a prediction market, you don't need to know who's good. You can just open it up to everybody and let them self-select. You also don't need to know what the biases are, in the sense that you're empowering participants to go searching themselves for biases and rewarding them for correcting them. And so now it's up to them to go find and fix the biases. And if you have a wide enough competition with people with strong enough incentives to find and fix the biases, you probably can't do better than to look at the results of what they produced.
And in some markets, you want to check as well that the markets are properly setting up the incentives.
Right.
For low probability events that could cause very large harms, there are more ways for the incentives to come apart than for higher probabilities of smaller harms, because it's more often that somebody just thinks, well, like, I'll never get hit by this, and that introduces human bias, or their assets, what they stand to lose, doesn't come close to the scale of the damages that could be caused, and taking steps to try and correct that may be helpful.
If I could, Robin, I am interested though in why it is that prediction markets, although they have a lot of these theoretical advantages, if you do head-to-head comparisons with surveys, just taking the unweighted average, rarely do they do substantially better. And at least in our experiments where you did head-to-head comparisons with these sort of weighted surveys, in which you did assign greater weight to the people who were historically more accurate, those surveys did better than prediction markets. So do you think that the prediction markets were less accurate in those cases because they weren't sufficiently monetized? Or what would be the explanation?
So it depends on which kind of surveys you have in mind. So like national surveys on elections, the prediction markets have been doing better than the surveys. Do you have in mind surveys where the participants had a personal incentives, like with scoring rules, that sort of?
Yeah, so Breyer score, for
instance. Right, so that's different than an ordinary survey. The audience might not realize. You're talking about a really high-quality survey here.
Yeah, a probability survey. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
So I'm going to make weaker claims about how prediction markets compare to some other very high-quality institution. I'm going to say we should be using high-quality institutions out there.
All right.
But are incentives, in fact, crucial or no?
Yes, absolutely.
And there were incentives in the surveys you're talking
bragging
about.
Rights.
Bragging rights.
Yeah, so...
Do economists count that as an incentive?
If you care about it, yeah.
Okay. Well, so one example of the kind of arguable bias in prediction markets was came up a few weeks ago with Brexit, where the prediction markets, I mean, it's hard to say with any one prediction that the markets, yeah, you know, got it wrong, but they did give a pretty low probability to exiting. And one theory that was floated around a lot was that, you know, the kind of people who participate in prediction markets are so different from the, like, average voter in England, that that's the kind of bias that really could, that just wouldn't get washed out by having a large number of participants, if those participants are all the kind of person who wants to be in a prediction market.
I don't know if it was a bias, but definitely after this story, there's thousands of people out there looking for this bias next time. This won't happen the next time. Everybody's all watching out for it. That's the whole point. People are looking out for biases. They don't catch them all, but when they get a clue of one, they'll be all over it.
The probability didn't sink that low. I mean, if people had been really confident that it wasn't going to happen, it might have been down at 5% on Brexit or something by the time it was getting quite close. Well, I think even on the day, it was maybe at 20%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 20%. I mean, 80% forecast means you're going to be wrong one out of five times. So I think you should just look at the long-term statistics. Looking at individual cases and trying to reason about bias is just it's just a lost cause.
I agree.
There are big data sets. Look at those.
I guess many people have made arguments about how prediction markets, you know, work out just fine in the long run. Eventually, they self-correct with enough liquidity. They self-correct for individuals' biases, et cetera. And I'm wondering if this is if this is practically useful, or if the kind of liquidity and long run you would need in order to get those promised benefits would just be greater than, you know, we're going to feasibly have in the short run.
I've run lab experiments with prediction markets with three people, only one of whom traded in 5 minutes, and it worked fine.
Wait, that you can't be claiming that as a general.
No, the point is, it's about how big should a meeting be or how long should it last? Well, meetings should be bigger or smaller or last longer or shorter, depending on the topic and how much effort you want. Yes, if you put in more effort, you'll get a better answer, but sometimes you want a quick meeting with a fast answer. Prediction markets can cover that whole range. Very large ones with a lot of efforts, high accuracy, and very smaller ones that give you a quick answer. So honestly, I mean, there are all these variations on when exactly prediction markets are more or less accurate compared to other high-quality mechanisms. But the main action here is using high-quality mechanisms versus all the other things we usually do. I think the main thing to ask here is why in so many areas of our life don't we do the basic things, like not only not using prediction market, we don't use a randomized experiment, we don't look at track records. There's just whole areas of our world where the very simplest predictions aren't used.
I feel odd being the non-academic here who will give the standard academic response, but I would say more research is needed. I think we still know very little about the relative performance of these methods, including prediction markets, which seem to perform well in the tournaments where they've been tested, but there are just so few of these. So I guess I would support maybe Robin's broader goal of just ensuring that more parts of society keep score about the forecasts that they do make so that we can learn more.
Do you have any more advice for EAs trying to make their own predictions, maybe before or outside of institutions being set up for heuristics to use?
We don't have that much time, but there's a very basic issue. I think it's relevant for this crowd, which is choosing to look at a question yourself and make your own judgment versus looking up the usual experts and looking what they think. Mm-hmm. And
before or instead of?
Instead of, often. So that's often a choice many people feel they face. They either think it through themselves and then, you know, if find they disagree with the experts, figure the experts must be all wrong, or they, you know, just go look up the experts and believe it. And the question is, how often and when to trust your own evaluation of something versus to look up the usual experts. You know, obviously, effective altruism at some level is disagreeing with the usual set of experts on charity, so you have some sort of a stance that they're getting it wrong. But how often and where, you could go too far in deciding all the usual experts are all wrong about everything and having to think through everything for yourself. That can go pretty wrong, too.
Although, does it really count as disagreeing with the experts if the experts just aren't optimizing for the things you're optimizing for?
Well, they might claim otherwise, so.
One thing I might say is try to calibrate your judgment on this. Like, try and make predictions via whatever means. Maybe sometimes it'll be pretty informal, sometimes it'll be more formal, and then see how they turn out. Or even you can, sometimes you can calibrate even by not waiting to see how they turn out, but by comparing to another source that you trust more. Like, use a method that you're wondering about testing out, and then go and consult the experts, and then you'll work out, because consulting the experts is sometimes a slow process, and it's nice to know methods which are faster than that, and to know how far you should trust them.
Mm-hmm. I think, a couple resources I would recommend is, you can read Phil Tetlock and Dan Gardner's book, Super Forecasting, which describes the empirical support for a range of different techniques that were shown to improve individual and group accuracy. And then there's Danny Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, on techniques for just thinking better in general. But I think there's also the other part of this, the question about what makes good forecasts are the forecasting methods that don't involve people, or involve people but only for a small part of the process. So to what extent should we rely on statistical models as opposed to human judgments? Mm-hmm. And the research on statistical versus human judgment going back decades suggests that in general, if you have enough data to make a simple model, you should. And you should probably go with that rather than with an expert judgment. But there's likely to be corner cases where that's not true. We know very little about that. So at IARPA, we're running a new research program called the Hybrid Forecasting Competition to pit humans against models, but also hybrids of the two. So where does it make sense to combine human judgments and a statistical model or a machine learning algorithm? How can you make best use of both?
Excellent.
Of course, any statistical model is endorsed by a person. So at some level, somebody is saying, my judgment is you should believe this model.
It's not completely pure and untouched from human hands.
Exactly.
True. Well, we're just about out of time, so I'm going to wrap up the discussion here, but I think at least some of our panelists are going to be around for the rest of the conference. Excellent. So you can bombard them with your extra questions later. For now, we'll close. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks.